With the rise of generative AI, it became a lot easier to create content. A lot of content. But is that what we need? What if, instead of focusing on creating even more, we spend more time cleaning up outdated and irrelevant content? That's why we at Anewspring champion World Learning Content Cleanup Day on March 21st. Want to join? Then share your tips and tricks using the hashtag WLCCD. Good luck cleaning!
What are we talking about this time on The Learning Hack? And for that matter, what even is The Learning Hack? Who am I? Who are you? It's all so uncertain.
Welcome to The Learning Hack, a podcast about the people and technologies that are creating the future of learning. I'm John Helmer.
Now guess what?
Learning is cool.
I'm learning.
Learning is fun.
And knowledge is power.
Research shows that job uncertainty tends to make a more significant toll on our health than actually losing our job. As human beings, we hate uncertainty. But that's what we're talking about this time on the podcast. And to give us some answers about how we deal with uncertainty and maybe help us to feel better about it, we've invited in not one but two highly qualified experts on uncertainty. Kate Fitzgerald, Head of Fact, who are they?
Hack Facts.
Catherine Templer-Lewis is a creative scientist and science communicator and co-founder of Kinder Studios. She studied neuroscience, anthropology and behavioural psychology at Oxford and UEA. Sam Conniff, author, speaker, producer, director and strategic consultant, is known for his best-selling book, Be More Pirate. He is CEO of Uncertainty Experts and has qualifications from the Universities of Oxford and Cumbria and Cranfield School of Management.
New research into the brain seems to indicate that it might be a sort of prediction engine. Just as ChatGPT makes us believe it can think, just by completing sentences, essentially, all we're trying to do in our lives, perhaps, is get to the end of the sentence to predict where it might end up. And we crave information about the future, therefore, and ambiguity terrifies us. And yet, we're living in a time of huge uncertainty about the future. Countries that are home to nearly half the world's population will hold elections in 2024. Meanwhile, the climate's going mad and geopolitics seem balanced on a knife edge. I wanted to know if all this uncertainty is really as unprecedented as it seems, and whether Catherine and Sam could perhaps give us some useful advice about how to deal with it. So Catherine, Sam, it's great to have you on the podcast. Welcome aboard The Learning Hack.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Thank you very, very much for inviting us along.
Welcome. You bill yourselves as uncertainty experts. This is a podcast for learning people, and we have often decried a tendency of people in the space to chase after the abstract noun of the month, be it resilience, curiosity, whatever, and whistle up a consultancy proposition or a bunch of e-learning courses around that. Of course, nobody ever did that. Sorry to sound so cynical. What could you say to reassure us that there is more to uncertainty than just a fashionable word and a load of fancy language?
Who wants to go first? I mean, I think we've got a lot to say on the topic of uncertainty. Sam, after you.
I think you're okay. Both
fashionable and fancy. That's I hope I'm not a trend though. Yes, I mean, I think the first thing to note is that when we started researching and working in uncertainty, it definitely wasn't a trend. It wasn't a word used at all. People didn't even recognize that they had a problem with uncertainty. In fact, everything we were trying to do was about certainty. You know, uncertainty is bad for the economy. It's bad for politics. Even AI is built on predictive processing models. You know, we were living in this culture when we started this project very much trying to cling on to certainty. I think the pandemic really changed that, and we had this sudden realization that things are uncertain and actually we don't have the skills to navigate it very well. And what we saw was suddenly this rise of this word uncertainty, you know, when it wasn't even a concept we studied much in science. It was just a sort of a way the world was. And now there's this huge interest. And I really do believe it's not just a trend. It's a realization and understanding that the world is very uncertain. We live in these very dynamic, complex systems, and we really need skills to tackle uncertainty. So I think, yes, it's not a trend. It's a sort of realization and a waking up to it.
Yeah, I'd echo that. I mean, I wonder what the opposite of a trend is, because I think it's definitely that. You know, the first written kind of explanation of why uncertainty is a paradox that we must reconcile is in Vedic texts, and it's then well documented from 2000 years BC in the Buddhist philosophy, and you know, even Jesus got some mentions of it. We can chart our way through Charles Darwin, Albert Einstein, you know, all the way to Huberman, whoever's perspective. I mean, that's a lot of white men listed out towards the end there. Whoever's perspective it is that we take on how we organize the big thinking aspects of the world, there has been a very consistent refrain that uncertainty is a necessary component of life. And the reason why I think now it's important and not a trend is because it has been, through the lens of science particularly, argued, as Catherine just said, as a concept. But many of the theoretical frameworks around uncertainty, and I think the parts of the conversation which you rightly are skeptical towards, look at it as a cognitive challenge. And if we look at that, certainly from a learning perspective, there's a lot of resistance to change that happens. The only way to get past that, and why very often change and change programs don't work, is because we need to accept and appreciate that uncertainty is a feeling. It's an emotion as well as an idea. And in the kind of classic frameworks, the VUCA framework and others, they tend to overlook that. And so if you just approach uncertainty, or allow the risk of it to become a trend, a concept, an idea, something new, you both mistake this deep-rooted ancient wisdom and the fact that it's a feeling. And if you try and think your way through it alone, you'll find yourself surprised that your learning or change program hasn't worked. If you don't bring people aboard emotionally through the difficult feelings of uncertainty, then you never get to the good side of it.
So we're much more alive, to it seems to me, in companies, especially nowadays, to other people's feelings. Some people have object quite strongly to the extent to which we're supposed to take people's feelings into account nowadays. So do you think this is part of the reason why uncertainty comes to the fore now, is that because we're more aware of that, it's the emotions around change and uncertainty that is that distinctive about your approach, do you think?
We have an emotional specialist on the team. So, you know, Catherine's knowledge around emotions has really helped and shaped my understanding of it. So I'll defer to you here, Catherine, and maybe come back with a perspective.
Yes, I think that very much that has been a realization in the world, but also in science. You know, emotions and reason and the mind and the body got split hundreds of years ago. It's a Cartesian split. And there's this sort of retraction of that idea. In fact, a scientist called Antonio Damasio wrote a beautiful book called Descartes' Error, in which he pointed out that people who have the part of their brain that registers emotion disabled cannot make decisions. They can't even decide what to have for breakfast. It's a really terrible state that they're stuck in. And with that, something else called somatic marker hypothesis came to the fore. And that is simply this understanding that not only are our emotions vital for our decision-making process, but they also don't live in our mind. Our emotions live in our body. And that goes back to this idea that uncertainty is a feeling, and it's a feeling we feel in our body. You know, we have sensations in our body, hearts beating faster, our stomach churns, and we realize we're afraid or we're in love. So I think there's been this huge turnaround in science around understanding this link between emotions and decision making, this understanding that our emotions are in our body, and with that, this realization of how uncertainties affect us both physically and emotionally all day long, and how that is impacting us negatively in terms of our behaviors, our ability to innovate, our ability to be creative, and our sort of ability to make decisions as well. And so that's all coming together, I think. And that's really the basis of the work where we started out. If we're going to teach people the skills to navigate uncertainty, it has to be with the understanding that uncertainty impacts us emotionally, that we need to change our relationship with us. And when it impacts us emotionally, that impacts not just our anxiety and well-being, but the way we make decisions, the way we're able to be creative, the way we're able to have empathy or diversity of perspectives. And that's incredibly important in the work world.
Yeah, and I wouldn't want to be judgmental, but in my experience working in learning with L&D professionals and working in the education sector, when the refrain comes along that emotions aren't valid or useful, there's often a fear of random. If you really zoom out, and emotions can be scary, you know, people can, you know, there's a narrative perhaps they're unreliable, but if you leave feelings behind, then you rely on the mind. And neither one on their own is a human being at their most reliable or their most adept or their most adaptive. There's a question that we ask in the work. If you ask people what they think about uncertainty, typically you'll get a fairly balanced response. Most people can conceive of the notion that uncertainty perhaps is uncomfortable, somewhat problematic, but it's also a space of growth. That's very common. We then ask a different question, which is, how does uncertainty make you feel? And you might guess, right, that there's a relative split that goes here as well. But when you actually ask people to respond with an emotional state, the overwhelming response is negative. In fact, about 95% of the responses to that question, and this is from a sample in the many thousands on an international basis across a number of different demographics, so a fairly reliable sense, our research sits against robust control groups. 95 or thereabouts percent of the responses we get are in the negative. So very, very few people say the feeling it gives me is of curiosity or excitement or potential. Overwhelmingly, it's of anxiety or sleeplessness or fretfulness or worry or purposelessness. And there comes the clue. If you just respond to it as a cognitive challenge, yes, sure, people can see the upside in it, but they don't take into account what might be the beneath the surface, you know, the place where resistance comes from. And so our work follows a framework drawn on those states, because that's where the barriers really come. And of all of these thousands upon thousands of adjectives describing people's emotional states, they all clustered into three categories. And the first was those words like uncertainty makes me anxious and fretful. We called that fear. The second was uncertainty makes me indecisive or feel circular or just a bit WTF or closed-minded. So we called that fog. And the third state was uncertainty just makes me purposeless, you know, makes me listless, it makes me feel meh. And so we called that stasis. And so I think it's an important contribution to the conversation, both to follow this line that there's both a separation and a chance for connection in brain and body. And if we don't understand the emotional states that it causes people, even if they're resistant or even if they're fearful, they are still a fact. And that's really where the barriers to change, learning and progress can often come from.
If we look now at what's causing all this uncertainty, what I'd really like to know is, what's really new, do you think, about the uncertainty of this particular moment? Obviously, we have a record number of elections this year. We come through a pandemic. We've had Ukraine. We've had Gaza. A pretty unstable geopolitical situation overall. Things are admittedly more in flux on the world stage than in some other years. But for those at the bottom end of society, isn't life always pretty uncertain? And is life any more uncertain now than in the 1930s, say, as you mentioned, the First World War, the early modern era, the Black Death, the ancient world, and so on? And you did kind of allude to that historical perspective, but what is distinctive about the things that are causing uncertainty at the moment?
I love that was so polite. Would you like to answer that, Sal, or shall I?
I've just gone on a bit, so you know, I think it would be good to hear from
so
you.
Kind. There is a big difference. The world, the fabric of life is no more uncertain, you know, as the Buddhists have pointed out. But our relationship to the world has changed. To start with, we've become super connected. We are connected now to more people, more things, more moments, and with it, more moments of uncertainty. And what we find is we're now living in these complex systems, you know, where you can't necessarily predict what's going to happen because one tiny thing, you know, can actually have huge impacts. And so we're always inundated, whether that's by digital connection, whether it's by nature of the number of sort of interactions we have every day, with many, many more micro moments that can be uncertain. So that's sort of the first thing, I think. And the second thing is that's sort of if you're looking across the last 100 years. The second thing, if you sort of take a wider look, across time, is that our brains evolved in a place, in a time that uncertainties were much more limited and much more sort of physical. You know, we have a wonderful safety protection in our brain where when things are unknown, we panic. You know, our brains, they now think, are what's called predictive machines. It's called predictive processing. All we're trying to do every day is stay safe by using our past experience and knowledge, stories we've been told, what we know about the world, to make predictions about what's going to happen next. You know, that's really why when you don't know what's about to happen or when things change, and of course uncertainty is the unknown, but also new things, different things, our brain panics. It can't keep us safe. You know, its default is try and avoid that uncertainty or seek certainty. And that really is the paradox of uncertainty. There's one part of us always wanting to shut us down, to take us away from the uncertainty, to quickly seek clarity, whether that's using your biases, the shortcuts in your brain, whether it's by, you know, actually doing things you've done before, making assumptions about the world. It can be highly dangerous. Whereas once this was fine because, you know, for example, a rustling in the trees was probably going to be a tiger jumping out at you or the wind, and it's better to play safe. Now we have all these conceptual and psychological uncertainties like climate change, the cost of living, which have the same physical reaction on us. And playing it safe doesn't always help us. And the paradox being is that we also know the reason why we have survived this long, because we're actually quite weak as animals. We don't have fur, we don't have claws, we don't fight very well, is because it's in moments of uncertainty that we can also become more open-minded, more pliable, more adaptable, more innovative, and that helps us. And what we find is the difference between whether you're going to shut down and try and avoid the uncertainty or open up and look for new solutions and adapt all comes down to something called your uncertainty tolerance. And that's a psychological trait within us that you can not only measure, but you can improve. And part of our work is how can you turn that into practical skills that we can teach people to apply to their everyday life, to the uncertainties at work, the uncertainties at home, because this realization is that we're not very well equipped for this inundation of uncertainties that we now encounter every day.
That certainly feels true to me that, you know, just this morning I wanted to check the weather, picked up my phone. It's a bit UK-centric, this bit. We have a lot of listeners in North America and so on. But just this morning, the Prime Minister said that the country is collapsing into mob rule. Right. You know, that wouldn't have happened in the early modern period. I was a peasant looking out of the kind of window of my hovel to check what the weather is like. I see what the weather's like. Yes. Suddenly this stuff is kind of coming in on us all the time.
But Sam, I think that's really, really true. And I would imagine from my North American friends, they're having a similar experience.
There's a lot of uncertainty in North America.
Catastrophe of leadership is also saying a bunch of bizarre things. One of the things I've learned from Catherine is something around kind of like our evolutionary states, right? And there are these kind of four conditions that we needed to get this far. And sustenance, and typically, you know, over the last 200,000 years, that's got easier to find, and shelter, and that's also generally for most people got easier to find, and social groups also easier to do. And then survival is the final one. And survival at a human level is really the avoidance of uncertainty. It's why we're so primed as we are to threats and the responses that we have. And arguably that one's got more difficult because, yes, the saber-toothed tiger metaphor, and that kind of goes to show, if it was the caveman version of us, we'd all be, or the cave person version of us, we'd be saying these are the most uncertain times ever, as would anybody in any generation. But that sense of what triggers a threat response, because that's a notification, that's the headline you saw this morning, the anxiety levels of your neighbors, that's, you know, the ceaseless warning of change all around you. So all of those things trigger a response in the body. And that's the one area which has got much, much, much more difficult to deal with. At the same time, our capacity has diminished as human beings over the last 50 years, or even post-industrial revolution, we sleep less. Anxiety is higher. Our social groups are smaller. Our overall life satisfaction has diminished. Like, these are the kind of internal capacities or abilities with which we respond. And I think there's this, certainly as I think about the L&D people in my network and world, there's a stat that I learned recently that really, I can't shake it out of my head. In 2016, the average employee went through two enterprise level events a year. So like a major reorg, restructure, transformation of system software, you know, the kind of thing we really need to prepare and take people through in a transformation perspective. The stat I read was that in 2022, that was now 10. 10 enterprise level events. That means they've got to be permanently overlapping. I'm in my mid 40s. When I began my career, I remember that kind of your average year was, you know, a lot of interest, a lot of learning, lots of periods of stability, punctuated by two or three moments of absolute total bloody chaos, right? And, you know, then you'd know when you were going through them that there was this kind of narrative amongst you. It's going to be all right. We'll just get to Christmas or March, whenever it's going to be. And for anyone who's gone through the last couple of years, it's the total opposite. You know, life at work is a total constant period of upheaval and change. The change is constant is now just a cliche. And yet I think partly the exhaustion comes because we still have the expectation that this period of calm is going to come. And we're still in a mindset of a few years ago where these periods of relative stability is where we'll kind of gather and muster and replenish ourselves rather than prepare ourselves for this permanent state of change being one that can be generative and then train ourselves how to have restorative moments within it rather than wait. Like I say, I think the expectation somewhat comes from the exhaustion comes from the expectation that that's about to shift. And I think truly that's the bit that's different from any other person's experience over the last couple of hundred years.
The Learning Hack podcast is supported by Learning News, the learning sector's newswire. Rob and his team are good friends of the podcast, and we really value the help and advice we've had from them, and they do a great job. For the very latest news from around the learning sector, for interviews with learning leaders, the latest from learning sector vendors and features on workplace learning, go to learningnews.com.
We've laid out the problem quite comprehensively. How about some solutions? Looking at the personal and the interpersonal, and really this is for both of you, I think, what's the science got to tell us about living with uncertainty? What practical steps can you give people about living with uncertainty?
I mean, what's been wonderful about this work is sort of, well, firstly, the opportunity to do sort of our own research. We've been working with UCL. I think we have about 20,000 people now. We've researched and as Sam mentioned, looked into what the impact of uncertainty is. And of course, there's a lot that we know from cognitive science and theory as well. You know, and as I mentioned, the first thing to know is that our brains are these prediction machines. And so they will always hate uncertainty, naturally. That's part of who we are. But we can also master our minds and our bodies. And that's the clue. It's about learning how to be aware of your relationship with uncertainty, how it's impacting your body and emotions, how it's impacting your mind and the behaviours that you do, and then work from there to increase your uncertainty tolerance. And this is really necessary. As Sam mentioned, being in uncertainty all the time is unsustainable. That's why we feel so exhausted. You know, what happens in a moment of uncertainty is your sympathetic nervous system is switched on. In normal life, this is normal life. What should then happen is there is, as Sam mentioned, a period of stability in which your parasympathetic nervous system switches on. You recharge, you rest. We're on this always on, you know, at work, things are coming at us left, right and centre. That's why burnout is so high. Uncertainty is the key driver of generalised anxiety disorder. It's the greatest thing that we know. So where do we start? Well, as Sam said, we split your reactions into uncertainty into three sections. The first is fear, the second is fog, and the third is stasis. The fundamental is the emotional regulation piece. You know, it's not been until recently, until the likes of Huberman and Wim Hof, particularly trendy to talk about, especially in the business sense, our need to regulate our emotions and how we do that. You know, and there's lots of different techniques from learning to recognize your emotions, something called interoception, a very, very popular rising field of neuroscience, to being able to regulate what's called your vagus nerve, whether that's through exercise, breath work, all these trips and ticks. That have
Sorry,
one sort of,
what's your vagus nerve? Can you?
Oh, yes, your vagus nerve. Yes, I shall explain. There's a terrible joke in science, which is what happens in the vagus nerve stays in the vagus nerve, which doesn't even really work as a joke, but it's always used.
Your vagus, it's a sort of Las Vegas of the brain.
Yes, it's the nerve that runs from the back of your brain or the bottom of your brain stem all the way down into your body, into your nervous system. It's the roadway, it's the central roadway that sends messages between your body and your mind. And what we now know is because emotions impact your body first, they're physical sensations, the way to calm your emotions, to regulate your emotions, is not through your mind. It's very hard to think away an emotion. It's through your body. And the way you can do that is the easiest, the simplest way is actually breath work. By slowing your breathing, you send a message from your brain down the vagus nerve, and that actually calms your emotions. And we know that when your emotions are calm, they don't distort our thinking. And that's incredibly necessary in the work domain, because you can't have your emotions permanently distorting the way you're thinking. So you need to keep a clear head. So there's lots of ways to improve your vagus nerve. Things like ice baths or cold showers are amazing, because what that does to your body is it elevates your nervous system as if you're afraid. And then through sort of using your mind and calming yourself and using your breath, you actually send a message down the vagus nerve to calm your emotions, and that strengthens it. So you'll see the sort of the vagus nerve, and Huberman does a lot of podcasts around the vagus nerve and how to regulate it. So step one really is that emotional piece, learning how to regulate your emotions. And then step two is learning how to master your mind, learning to recognize your biases. What are those biases that are shutting down your thinking? How can you open up your thinking? And the third one is actually connecting to your body and learning how to use intuition, your mind and your body together to make decisions.
It's interesting. It sounds like you've got a kind of scientific basis for why mindfulness is a good thing. You're not mentioning mindfulness, and I know that it has its detractors and there's a lot of it going on in organizational training. But what you're talking about sounds a lot like mindfulness.
Yeah, 100%. Mindfulness and meditation are, if you can access them, or whatever version you can access, is incredibly powerful as a tool, not just to help clear your mind, but also to regulate your emotions.
Yeah,
I go one further. So I definitely have been a detractor and skeptic around mindfulness and embodied practices. That's definitely how I came into this. So I'd add a couple of things. Firstly, the vagus nerve is definitely a lot more useful than Las Vegas. And then secondly, the uncertainty isn't the problem. So if the question is around how to live with uncertainty, it's firstly and fundamentally, uncertainty isn't a problem. It simply couldn't be a problem. It's such a fundamental component of life. It would be like saying the weather is a problem. The problem, or the challenge, or the opportunity, is our relationship with uncertainty. Our relationship with uncertainty is what changes it from a place that shuts people down as a negative state or a limiting state to being a liberating state, a generative place, a positive place full of ideas. And it's true of everyone's experience of life. You know, it doesn't take long to look to science or history to spot the relationship between moments of uncertainty and great innovation and change. But every single person listening will be able to think about the greatest moments in their career, the most memorable moments in their life, and recognize there is a relationship with a degree of risk or a degree of unpredictability or a degree of chance, and their capacity to navigate, to hold that, to explore it directly resonates. And the most predictable moments of our life were rarely the most memorable. So the opportunity is this psychological state that Catherine mentioned, uncertainty tolerance. And the great thing is it's incredibly malleable. The program we have is one way, and it means that in just a few hours, people's uncertainty tolerance shifts. Like, it really does move. And one of the things for people like me who might be a bit wary of aspects of mindfulness or embodied practice is the science is really and truly clear. And it's probably the biggest lasting difference it's made on my life. Because on the kind of embodied side, I think it's Ken Robinson who said brilliantly that his body is just a vehicle for getting his mind to different meetings. And I think that's how I felt coming into this, until this process of like somatic market theory, the idea that emotions become data. We make better decisions when we're using our full cognitive ability, as well as understanding the millions of sensors that are going on at the same time. And that allows us to step into that final place. You know, I think one of the good arguments for mindfulness is to ask ourselves, what's the opposite of mindfulness? And that really resonates to me. When we started this project and we were putting it out into the world, the responses we were getting from firms were really, you know, desperate. We want confidence. We want clarity. The world feels so confusing. The teams are burning out. We need to adapt faster. And we could never offer that. We can't offer confidence or clarity in the face of uncertainty. What we do offer is a sense of curiosity and of collaboration. And these are very difficult skills in times of uncertainty, because everyone wants full certainties. I think it's Satya Nadella who said, you know, we've got to move from a place where we're expecting our teams to know it all to giving them the power and confidence to think they can learn it all. And that, I think, speaks more truly to the opportunity. Catherine just said there that one of the things that's demonstrated is uncertainty increases the brain's state and optimum capacity for learning. And this is shown again and again. We become heightened a level of awareness. You know, more information can go in. We actually become more malleable. More neuroplasticity takes place in moments of uncertainty. So it's actually an optimum learning environment. It's like a paraphrasing of the old F. Scott Fitzgerald line. You know, there's no higher state of intelligence than being able to hold two opposing thoughts in mind at once and maintain the capacity to function. Like, it really does push us into a place where it has a really positive generative relationship with learning.
And I should add, so just, you know, we're talking a lot of sort of scientific theory here, which obviously is my happy place. But a lot of the research and the skills that we've learned and we teach people came not just from the labs, but from an amazing collection of people who actually Sam introduced the research lab to, who we call the uncertainty experts, who have learned naturally to really thrive in uncertainty. And the real leaders that we need to look to. And these are people who are ex-gangsters, ex-refugees, RAF pilots, you know, all who have overcome adversity and now, you know, are CEOs and are legal reformers. And so I think that's what's been really exciting about this research, to see these skills. And some of them are just emotional regulation, you know, but when it's an ex-gangster or a drug smuggler explaining how important it's been in their life, you suddenly sit up and you go, right, actually, you know, these aren't soft skills at all. These have helped refugees, you know, get to a place of safety. These have helped people get through prison or, you know, as prisoner of wars. And so I think that's been really interesting to learn how, you know, learn from these people and learn skills that can be applied to our everyday life.
We talk a lot about technology in this podcast because it's such an important part of learning nowadays. Technology is a big driver both of opportunity and uncertainty. Sometimes it's force of liberation and sometimes force of oppression in some jurisdictions, but it's always a disruptor. Does the current big noise in technological advance, AI, add to uncertainty in any way that's new or unique? So, okay, it might replace jobs, but that was happening before. But are we really facing something unprecedented with the uncertainty that AI introduces?
I think it does offer, I mean, I've thought and discussed this at some length, and each time I go deeper on it, I find more reasons to believe. My argument at the beginning was no, that here we are with just another technology, and actually the things that drive the uncertainty around it is the kind of... very much the human fallibility of it all. You know, I have school-aged children, and so a large part of my life is unpicking the impact of mobile phones, smartphones, and social media on them. Now, that as a technology, when it was really introduced into the world 10 years ago, we had no real full understanding of the unintended consequences of it. But the recent study in the US takes into account 1 million young people and is unequivocal that the earlier they had access to that technology, the worse off their mental health is now. You know, there's a huge shift in the UK and the US and actually all around Western Europe, in fact, the world, in terms of this movement understanding. And we were once in a kind of bring your own device stage, what, 8 or 9 years ago, that was very much a trend in education, to now almost total bans. And so I'd bring AI back into the lens. And I think the capacity for uncertainty is that there is so little knowledge or understanding. Actually, let's go even further. There's such a vacuum of a plan of the long-term consequences of any kind of reflective depth or capability. And I don't think that the notion of legislation is really the answer, but even just a fucking, just like a moral framework for potentially...
There goes our clean rating, but I do appreciate your passion.
Here we are trying to unpick this desperately, you know, and it keeps made the comparison with like, you know, cigarettes 20 years ago still being sold for their health benefits. And now we are doing this, you know, the health benefits of technology access to young people. And where are we going to be in 10 years trying to unpick the question of the impact of AI? That's the bit which makes me feel there's demonstrable uncertainty. I was told recently by an AI consultant there's over 1 million known instances of blackmail using deep fakes, you know, creating pornographic or otherwise imagery of individuals and then threatening to release them onto the internet because they're so believable. And it just gives you a hint, or the usage of deep fakes and AI in the information war that's taking place in the unfolding tragedy on our screens in Gaza. You know, and it's that, those hints, and I don't think we have any idea of the outcome of it. Whereas previous technologies, we could, you know, you now think, God, we could have seen that coming. I don't think we've got any idea of what we may or may not see coming. And that's where I think the uncertainty comes from. Not necessarily the capacity of ChatGPT today, but the bits that we haven't thought of tomorrow.
That's interesting. I think for me, and maybe this is because I am a cognitive scientist, the dangers in AI come in our our perception and understanding and often misunderstanding of it. I think, you know, everyone talks about singularity, everyone talks about consciousness in AI. And yes, for sure, AI and its development has taught us lots of things that actually we got wrong, especially around language processing in the brain. But it's not a brain. It is a prediction machine. And I think uncertainty in AI is dangerous. Much like our brains, it uses bias, except its bias is embedded bias. The bias that an AI has is just from the programming, or if it's something like ChatGPT, from skimming incomplete data. So it's inconsistencies, bias that it gets from its data source or from the coding, or it's implicit as well. But then the ability to overcome that uncertainty. Now, of course, AI, it's about trying to make things more certain, make predictions. It can't address uncertainty as, I mean, I'm already starting to make it sound human, but an AI cannot address uncertainty as we can. All it does is seek more information, larger data sets to model on. And it lacks emotion, obviously. There is no such thing as a body or an embodied sense within AI. And so I think the danger is that we start to parallel the way AI works in uncertainty with the way we should work in uncertainty, just getting more information. And yes, of course, that is important. And recognizing our biases is very important. But again, it sort of negates this huge revelation about the importance of emotion and decision-making intuition. And I think that watching that play out has been quite interesting to me.
Yeah, I've railed quite a bit about the metaphors we use to understand AI and how we're constantly anthropomorphizing. But I think my experience of working quite a lot with ChatGPT is now to think that it's impossible. It's almost impossible for us to think about it without, no, I think it's completely impossible for us to think about the thing that we're interacting with without giving it human characteristics, without thinking of it as a, I don't know, I think of it as a kind of, you know, hyperactive, easily distractible intern that I'm working with, attempting to manage it. And that's, you know, that is it's kind of projection, because it's not, it's a kind of numbers-based system and all the rest of it. One thing I would say is that one thing that seems to me quite unique about AI is that previous kind of technological advances have gone in the direction of, we've assumed that automation is just going to take away all the routine tasks and the stuff we don't like doing, and we'll be left with the more interesting and creative stuff. Well, no, I mean, AI now wants to do that stuff for us. You see, I mean, I'm giving it intentionality. It wants to do this stuff, it wants to do that stuff for us. And the only stuff that is left for us is, I don't know, yoga teacher, picking up rubbish, you know, taking the care services, which are all, you know, completely wonderful and laudable things to do. But it seems to have turned that on its head. We no longer feel that technology works in the same way.
I think that's very common of the human experience. I think anthropomorphization, you know, most people have got given their car a name or their Hoover or various other inanimate objects. I think the question is, why do we do those things? And I think there are every now and then things that are so incomprehensible to us that we either like try to make it manageable to our minds, so we give it a cute name, or, you know, turn it into the kind of human framework that we can understand, or we refer to it as a miracle. And, you know, it's the kind of the polarity of what we do with the things that we don't understand. What we rarely do is try and get on the other side of it and create some kind of frameworks. And by that, I do mean values and principles and where does it go? I don't think the problem necessarily lies in us giving it a name, or the bizarre conversations and arguments I get into with ChatGPT, because, you know, that's what happens to us. I love the fact, Catherine, you said, you know, that everyone talks about singularity. It just kind of goes to show the kind of the circles that you hang around in. that's the idea where it goes. But it does, you know, that reminds me of the Ray Kurzweil thing, right? You know, the rate of change. And that's still the bit that I think is the most fascinating. We gaze at this thing. It's remarkable. The biggest challenge with AI, I think, is keeping up with the pace of new AI announcements. Like, and that's it. I can't even get further than the different things that are brought out. And to try to zoom out, and what is it with Kurzweil? Like, by the time that someone now who is 40 has reached 80, then what's new in a year will be new in a month, there or thereabouts.
Yeah, exponential growth, of technology.
Yeah, and it's that then sits me down, and it's that that stops me anthropomorphizing and realizing that there's something much more than a you know, sci-fi based kind of dialogue with an intentional intelligence.
I want to hop back a bit now to how we can turn uncertainty into opportunity via a publication of your own, Sam. You wrote a very successful book called Be More Pirate. And this is a kind of strain of thought that has its adherence in the learning world, as you probably know. We had Lauren Waldman on the podcast a while ago, who calls herself the Learning Pirate. And I got a free T-shirt, which I'm wearing now.
I'm very grateful for you making me aware of her work. And I'm by the time this podcast is out, I will have been in touch with her. So there might be some kind of co-pirate, cross-pirate collaboration to let you know about that you've begun.
Marvellous. It's like first dates for the learning industry. But what can we learn from the history of pirate communities about dealing with uncertainty? I mean, you know, there are other books in this space as well. David Graeber wrote a book about pirates in Madagascar and so on that came out recently. I mean, before his death, he's recently died, sadly. What can we learn from the history of pirate communities about dealing with uncertainty?
A few things. So the thing that hopefully I contributed to the literature around pirates and the role they play is I argue they exist on the long arc of the working class movements for social change. And so that encompasses access to learning and education as well as it does equal rights. Because in this very profound period specifically that I look at, which is the golden age of piracy, almost exactly 300 years ago, it was coming to a close around 1725. What you've had is three generations of people whose livelihood had once been exactly the same methodology that had then been rebranded as piracy. And for half the lifespan of pirates, they were never pirates in their own minds. They'd just been doing what their forefathers had done, which was, you know, robbing at sea under license from Queen and country as the Britain laid down the foundations of its imperious approach. But what really gets interesting, and this is relevant to all organizations, L&D and otherwise, is when the system resists change, what are the groups that create change? And so, you know, in this world that looks a little bit familiar, you know, post an awful pandemic, a series of interconnected international conflicts, which no one quite understands, you know, a lack of demonstrable democracy and a sense of agency, a group of individuals reject these norms of society and decide to create a new and slightly more sophisticated model. And on their boats and in their ships, they decided to have fair pay because that was a very logical idea in response to the circumstances they were in. They decided a form of dual executive democracy because that was also a very sensible idea. And these ideas were popping up. You know, that's why there were revolutions around the world taking place. And this was a further petri dish of those same thoughts. There was the beginnings of kind of a level of diversity and equality that hadn't been seen on Earth, but it was beginning to pop up in numerous conversations around the world. And there's no surprise that the once famous pirate founding fathers had overlapping relationships with the founding fathers of the United States because these ideas went off ships and onto land. And in Nassau, a pirate republic, not the one David Graeber writes about, but one that's more historically accurate, were formed. And these ideas then begin to transcend and follow through. I think they're next really picked up in the cooperative movement. The six founding principles of the cooperative movement mirror directly seven of the consistent pirate codes that are known to be true. And then into the trade union movement. And then we see workers' rights enabled that had been seen on board a pirate ship, workplace compensation, equality of reward. And they continue to be seen in the civil rights movement. The suffragettes were known to have drawn inspiration from some of the female pirates. So it's a consistent story of how individuals resist change by creating better models. And that was really it. Pirates weren't these deliberately forward-thinking, liberal-minded, you know, progressives. They just rejected the stark unfairness and the woeful inadequacy of the systems that they were within. You know, the various navies were awful places to work. So of course they created better systems. And then those systems had benefits that then created ripples and others began to follow. And that's the bit which I think is both remarkable and interesting and particularly powerful for now. My observation was that because I was just really bloody frustrated, I'd spent 18 years working in youth development, training, coaching, mentoring, social enterprise, and I just could not be darned if I'd ever be invited along to another meeting about innovation where lots of ideas went up on the wall, things were given different names and nothing actually changed. So that's why I wanted a story with a different level of potency and power. But to begin with, really, the book was more of a kind of way of venting my frustrations. I didn't design it to become what it has become. And in education particularly, It's found a real home. I've worked with hundreds of schools and thousands of school leaders. I've worked with L&D leaders in organizations worldwide because it has an ability to both take people's frustrations and then harness them with their limitations. And so once you get people to talk about what they really want to change, it gets people to have the conversations they have in the pub after work or with their partner about the things they wish could be different at work. And then it allows them to step apart the things that hold them back or stop them bringing them up. And all of a sudden it pushes them into the unknown. Like, because when you really do change, proper change, it's an emotional sport, right? Like we were saying earlier on, it's not just this is what I think should be different, but oh God, now it feels different. And that's when you've taken people off the edge of the map, which Pirates does, you then need to give them tools for uncertainty, which is kind of retrospectively how Catherine's helped me realize these two projects link.
And I've just realized that this would have been a podcast on its own. So because that raises so many questions for me. But I do have to kind of be conscious of the time or the YouTube file gets too big for me to upload. What advice?
We can talk about Pirates another time.
Yeah. Well, yes, you're welcome to come back and maybe we'll get you together with Lauren. Which would be
love
a lot.
That.
Yeah. Coming back to practical steps and advice, what advice would you give for anybody who's looking to survive, mitigate, or leverage the effects of uncertainty in their working life? So, focusing on the individual here, you know, I'm a professional. I want to have a rich and sustainable career. How should I mitigate or leverage the effects of uncertainty?
First thing I'd say is kind of something that we've mentioned, right? Uncertainty isn't the problem. Your relationship with uncertainty is both the problem and your opportunity. We're working with we've been working with numerous large firms recently. We're really lucky, Apple, Netflix, Nike, Novartis, you know, multi-industries. And one of the things that sport firms to us is a realization that one firm had 48 wellbeing programs, 26 leadership programs, and they couldn't even count the number of innovation initiatives they had. Uncertainty is what's known as, or uncertainty tolerance is a trans-diagnostic. That's how it's understood psychologically, because it's, yes, the biggest driver of anxiety, but it's also the biggest driver of a number of other issues. If you can get to grips with uncertainty tolerance, which is a relatively straightforward thing to do, and we'll actually be able to share with you, John, a free test that we've made for people to test their own uncertainty tolerance and that of their teams. Mm-hmm. You can begin to address all of those things. It's a rare point of strategic intervention that rather than constantly be what I call the worry-go-round of life, right? We spend our days worrying about the problems at home and then we get home to suddenly start realizing we're worrying about the things at work. We address everything in silos, not fully able to comprehend how interconnected they are because that's too large. Uncertainty tolerance gives you a rare opportunity to do that. And by increasing your uncertainty tolerance, you will, and this is not me saying, it's proven to have a causal relationship, improve your ability for strategic decision-making, creative problem-solving. You'll reduce the drivers of anxiety. So rather than allowing uncertainty to feel overwhelming, you can know that uncertainty tolerance is pretty immediately achievable, and it will have this demonstrable effect across a range of different issues.
And I said that word sort of uncertainty tolerance, you know, it allows you to remain in uncertainty without anxiety getting the better of you. And if you can remain in uncertainty, that's when you can start to absorb new information, look for new possibility, head towards the goal that you want, you know, hold a space of doubt so you can make a better decision than one that is just, you know, clinging to certainty or doing what you've done before. And I think it really, with it, that the sort of the first and probably the most fundamental step to increasing uncertainty tolerance is this awareness of your relationship with uncertainty. How do you feel in a moment of uncertainty? Where do you feel it on your body? You know, what is your automatic reaction when you feel anxious because of uncertainty? You know, is it that glass of wine? Is it suddenly CCing everyone to another email that doesn't need to actually be even an email? You know, is it slight passive aggression or saying yes to something at work that you're then 100% not going to follow through on?
So I'll get on the WhatsApp group nowadays. If you're a politician, get on the WhatsApp group and say something ill-advised that will be brought back at a public inquiry. Yeah.
Exactly. All these little things we do. But that recognition takes some time for reflection, which we never, ever do. We never sit down for 5 minutes and think, what was my intuition telling me? Or how did I feel about that? You know, and a lot of studies have shown that even 5 minutes reflection on how we've reacted to things, whether that's in the shower in the morning or before you know, turn the lights out at night, can really help you understand your relationship. And once you understand how you're behaving, how you're feeling, that's when you can put the tools into place to change it. And then because of, you know, the joy of something called neuroplasticity in the mind, whereby, you know, habitual behavior becomes habitual behavior after sort of you grow new neurons in the brain to accommodate it. When you start to change your behavior and the way you're reacting or responding rather than avoiding uncertainty, after a while that becomes your new way of behaving. That becomes hardwired into your brain. And that's when you can really feel your uncertainty tolerance allowing you to remain in that space. I should come out with a warning that we cannot remain indefinitely in uncertainty. It takes too much of a toll on our nervous system. So whilst it took me a long time to admit this because I didn't like the word routine, some bits of routine are very important, not just because, you know, of processes or things like this, but because certain routines we put in our life relieve us for a moment from uncertainties. So we always must find time to rest, recharge, and use routine as a positive thing.
There's another side to that, which is if you have responsibility for people within an organization, say you're in an L&D or HR role, if you're a teacher or a trainer, and you're balancing responsibilities of the individuals in your charge who you're helping towards learning, and also what the organization, the enterprise needs and kind of will allow and so on, what practical steps would you recommend for them in responding to the uncertainty that's impacting their workforce or their students or and their organizations?
I could speak to this a little bit based on some of the things that we've observed and we've heard are most useful, because it's probably the biggest community that we've served. In fact, last year we ran a program with the uncertainty experts just for the L&D teams that we've been working with, because whilst they could give us, you know, really amazing feedback and responses to how beneficial the program has been to their teams, it's like the old cliche of cobbler's boots or any other kind of industry. Very rarely did the L&D teams get the same level of support they're providing for their teams. So we ran a program for them for free to say thanks and give them some training. And as a result, we heard a number of really interesting things. One was the kind of post-resilience phase that we're in. And a bit like the diversity debate, very often resilience programs can feel, you know, not intentionally, that they place the onus of responsibility for the resilience of the organization on the shoulders of the individual.
Yes.
And that's tough.
Something I've often thought, and not many people say this, but it is, I mean, for some people it feels like it's part of neoliberalism. You know, the enterprise will throw whatever Sturm und Drang it wants to at you, the individual, and it's down to you to be resilient enough to get through it. So
absolutely,
you raise that point. Yeah,
and it individualizes the, you know, responsibility for the systemic level of mess, over dedication to productivity, you know, a number of different factors there, and then perhaps organizational chaos or a lack of resilience, and then, you know, again, I often think it's unintentional. I know lots of really excellent and well-meant resilience programs, and God knows I've relied upon my own, but is the work of Nassim Taleb and his book about anti-fragility that really helped us get here. It's like, well, what comes after? If the world is going to continue throwing these blows at us, what do we do? Ever more rely on our resilience as it gradually weakens around us, or ladder this up to something perhaps more useful? And in uncertainty tolerance, we found a way that you get, it's the difference between post-traumatic stress and post-traumatic growth, right? We all have to go through these events, and they might be stressful, they might be growth-orientated, they might be traumatic, whatever the word is, there is always a distinction between whether or not they lead to, it's an adversity quotient as well, whether or not it leads to some kind of opportunity for development. And that's not to say that everything has to, not every difficult thing must have a badge of honor and everyone's got their story of survival. I don't think that's truth at all. But as we're pushing forward, I think just relying on or mistakenly over-relying on individuals and their resilience, it feels like a falsehood. So we offer uncertainty tolerance. And in fact, Catherine's developed our own scale, the uncertainty to opportunity score, which takes in 5 existing scientific scales. Because again, rather than just get good at taking the blows, we want to enable people to get better, faster, smarter, more responsive, more agile in response to taking those blows, you know, deepen their own connection with a sense of self and their ability to make intuitive and rapid decisions rather than slow down in response to it all. That to me feels like the kind of fundamental, which goes to my point again about it's not uncertainty the problem, it's uncertainty tolerance, it's the opportunity. If there was a simple thing we could offer, it's a reframe. And I think that's how people come out of the program, no longer seeing, in fact, we ask this question at the beginning and the end, how does uncertainty make you feel? Like I said, typically fear, fog, or stasis. We ask people at the end, what's your new relationship with uncertainty going to be? And it's charming. People talk about dancing with it, laughing with it, having a new relationship with it altogether, seeing the opportunity of it. And that's that's at its core. We offer some real practical tools as well, but at its core, there's an opportunity to reframe that. When you reframe that, you reframe our entire outlook. You know, every single thing on the news, when we step outside, and just this kind of sense of overwhelm and stuckness that so many of us face, and so many of the teams that people listening to this will be looking after and care so much about. There's something profoundly simple in this, and deeply sophisticated too.
Hard to follow that, but go on, Catherine.
No, I mean, exactly. I sort of just agree with that. I think that's a great summation of the sort of research we've done and the revelations that we've done, and this realization that, you know, we have this wondrous capacity and uncertainty to, as we say, you know, do more, see more, be more. And it's not leveraged, but not necessarily through our own fault. We just haven't... it's not been a conversation we've ever had around uncertainty and our relationship to it. It's not been a skill set that has ever necessarily been given to us or provided for us. And I think that's the important change, whether that's, you know, whatever level you're at, right up into leadership level. Even the leadership frameworks used now are frameworks of decision-making that were implemented in times when things were a lot more, or organizations were a lot more static. You know, they're dynamic now, things are changing. And I think this call, this realization, so I think McKinsey, was it last year, they rated the top skills that you needed to be highly employable. They call them deltas. And the top two was adaptability and ability to cope with uncertainty. Now, of course, they're completely linked, because if you can cope with uncertainty, you become adaptable. So I think, yes, it's that realization of this skill set that we're potentially lacking and we need support with. And I think helping teams, helping individuals, helping leadership teams is going to have this sort of fundamental change that will ripple out. And the joy being is when you upskill to manage uncertainty in the workplace, those, of course, are the skills that you use at home, because your brain doesn't actually know whether you're at home or whether you're in the workplace. All uncertainties, you know, have an imprint on you.
It's inspiring to hear about the work that you've done with teams, organization, and with people to help them in this way, because it's something that, you know, all of us face. But I'd like to know, as we close out, who and where do each of you go to for your own inspiration, for your own knowledge and information? Who do you look up to in the learning space, but also outside, wherever? And who do you look out for? Who you think speaks sense, if you like, that you could recommend?
I want to know what your answer is to this, Catherine.
Well, my answer is that... Well, I was thinking sort of who have been, to me, been sources of inspiration as we've researched uncertainty and how to turn it into a skill set that is applicable in the workspace. And interestingly, I've mentioned him like three times now, is Andrew Huberman. He's a neuroscientist at Stanford. He has a podcast, which isn't necessarily, you know, about L&D, but it's about understanding your mind and your body. And it has so many tools, so much information on that emotional regulation piece, which we started with, is so important if you're navigating uncertainty. You know, and you know, we all know the impact of burnout and the importance of retention and how much you know, anxiety is a massive problem. So for things around that, I think Andrew Huberman's podcast is absolutely brilliant. In terms of sort of metacognition and a learning mindset, which is something we try to foster as well, which of course is really important for your problem-solving ability at work, I cannot recommend more Byron Katie. She wrote a book called The Work, which helps us combat the biases that we take into our thinking. And that's helped sort of inform how we teach skills on open-mindedness. There's also, you know, The Body Keeps the Score. I don't think a day goes by when we don't recommend this to someone by Bessel van der Kolk, which helps you understand the emotional and embodied aspect of uncertainty and what happens when you face challenges. So I think those are sort of go-tos. And when it comes to emotional intelligence, Lisa Feldman Barrett is amazing. And I think those are books and resources that can quite fundamentally change how you understand sort of uncertainty as a feeling and how it impacts you in the workplace. What have you got, Sam? I'm really interested to know.
I think inspiration we need to approach carefully. I think that we're in an interesting moment. Too much inspiration without action leads to frustration, or talk minus action equals shit, as the older equation goes. And I'm a sucker for it. You know, I love a course and another book and a podcast. And then I can often end up in kind of inspiration loops, wondering what to do. My inspiration, my deepest inspiration, is where this whole project came from, is usually from kind of the edges. And you mentioned this in your question earlier on about the different uncertainties in life and how they affect different people in society. And it is usually in society the same people who win and lose at the game. I spent 15 years running a social enterprise, providing opportunities, training and learning for young people who are typically excluded socially because they've been refugees or teen parents, or they've been in the justice system, or excluded from full-time education. And it took me about 5 years to learn that I was going to gain far more from this experience than any of them were going to gain from me. And even though we turned it into a sizable organization across multiple continents, you know, seeing tens of thousands of young people graduate to go and do wonders in the world, I still learned more. The transaction was never equal. And one of the things it gave me was both my route to understanding pirates and unexpected sources. I believe that innovation, true innovation, more likely comes from the edges than it ever does from the under the spotlight. And it was in the beginning of this development of this program and who is good at uncertainty. It was conversations with people, you know, these are UK stats, but there's about 12 million people living in poverty, 2.4 million people having an experience of single parenthood, which is where I was at the time the thing began, 240,000 kids in gangs, it's about 2.4 million veterans, you know, who's just to get to the end of the week is an exercise in extreme uncertainty to make ends meet and for things to add up. And the skills that are required to get there are overlooked or misunderstood. And you know, there's a lot of talk around lived experience, which I admire and am very interested in. And then at the same time, at the top of society, you've got a very different echelon. At the exact moment we began writing it, the UK Cabinet Office was made up of only three career paths, finance, law and media, with 80% of that being finance and law. And whilst there's lots of smart people in finance and law, that's not necessarily the full spectrum of ability and life experience. And so I have never gone through an experience that has taught me so much as the uncertainty experts. And my resistance to being embodied has been overcome by learning from ex-prisoners of war and people who've been refugees, fundamentally. Yes, with Catherine underpinning that with the scientific explanation as to the benefits to me. But there's not a day that goes past where I'm not applying the things that I've learned now from this really remarkable group of ex-smugglers, prisoners, and otherwise. And I think that's just a truism, right? I think all too often, we lean towards the existing hierarchies, even though particularly those of us in a learning environment know that those hierarchies have their flaws, and the lessons at the edges have always to me been so useful. And it kind of upends my notion of privilege, that often I think I'm most privileged to have had some of those shared experiences that have taught me so much. And so I continue to try to find ways to be in those spaces, knowing that they are uncomfortable, but it's definitely where I've learned more than anywhere else.
Well, best of both worlds, I think there.
Yeah.
Yes. Alice, thank you very much for that. It's been a really fascinating chat for me, and I'm sure that the listeners are going to get a lot of value from that. And I'd really like to thank you for taking the time. I thought that was brilliant. Cheers. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Thanks. That's all on the Learning Hack podcast for this time. Many thanks to our guest and to our sponsors.
The Learning Hack is among the top 5% most listened to podcasts globally, according to Listen Notes. But it depends for its existence solely on sponsorship and your Patreon contributions. If you want us to continue holding these excellent conversations about learning, and it's you that's told us they're excellent, let's have a chat about your company's sponsoring. Or sign up on patreon.com/learninghack. And for a piddlingly small amount of money, get transcripts, text summaries, and early access. Until next time.
Stay curious, learning people.